Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Jack Straw's Castle by Bithia Mary Croker. Major Blue of the Honorable East India Company's service hated all manner of men and loved all blends of whiskey. The result of this idiosyncrasy was that after suffering many things from him for many years, the officers of the South Nello Regiment revolted en masse. Endurance has its limits. If a comrade is a smart soldier and a good fellow, much is overlooked, but Major Blue was neither. And after an outrageous scene at an inspection dinner, he received a strong official hint to go. He left with a substantial pension. He was not broke, and carried away with him the detestation of a large body of men, an unparalleled grievance, and a deathless thirst for strong waters. The major did not return to his native land, but settled down on a hill station in Madras. Whether it was on the Nilgiris, the Polnis, the Cheverois, or elsewhere is immaterial. Suffice to say that he rented a four-room bungalow near a small station. It was cheap, in good repair, out of the way, and solitary. Standing on a bare hillside, almost surrounded and concealed by rows of funeral pines, and known by the name of Jack Straw's Castle. Here Major Blue took up his abode and made, as was his custom, life a purgatory to his miserable retainers. He had joined the service in the days when, among a certain set, cursing and beatings one servant was a fashionable and laudable action, and he prided himself that he was a conservative, had never discarded old habits, and that every domestic in his employment had been conscientiously and soundly thrashed. He failed, however, to mention the one grand occasion on which, having dragged an able-bodied chakra into his bathroom, there to belabor him privately and at ease, that too vigorous young man had administered to his employer such a drubbing that he was unable to leave his bed for weeks, and meanwhile the delinquent had decamped with the major's gold watch, silver spoons, and his pet cane. This had not been a lesson, and was an old story now. Major Blue was a notoriously bad master. His name was well noted in various bazaars. Why then did Hassan, his butler, and Ahmed, his cook, brothers, remain with him year after year? It was true that the wages were considerable, but what wages can repay a man for blows, kicks, curses, and insults? Major Blue had the gift of tongues, and his invectives were as glib and as coarse as those of any old Tamil grass cutter. The waterman and Dobi had a better time than the indoor domestics, not being so constantly in evidence, but no horsekeeper born of woman would remain 2 days, and the major kept no pony. Fortunately, for that quadruped. He invariably began the day with a hoarse, savage roar when his early morning peg was first introduced to him. As the hours went by, these roars increased and multiplied, accompanied by kicks and blows. Attendance on him was almost as dangerous as waiting on a wild beast. In fact, he was worse than some, for he threw bottles with a deadly aim, also lamps and scalding water. Rash indeed, the bill collector who ventured within his reach. To be brief, Major Blue was a degraded old savage, and yet some people declared that he could be a gentleman when he chose. Now and then he appeared in the local reading room and at church, red-faced, beetle-browed, blustering, but clothed, not to say dressed, and dapper, and in his right mind. But what about those other, alas, too frequent occasions when he was to be met singing and staggering along the high road, with the top buttons of his coat fastened in the lowest buttonhole of the said garment, and a guilty black bottle protruding from his pocket? He had no occupation. He made no attempt at gardening, beyond cultivating some red chilies, and his reading was confined to the local paper, which often accumulated unopened for weeks. He spent his days in swallowing strong pegs, smoking rank trichis, and harrying his staff by night and day. Foolhardy indeed, the man who dared to call his soul his own. The owner of Jack Straw's Castle was a slender, narrow-chested Eurasian named Ezra Pedro. He collected his rents monthly, and in person. Occasionally he arrived at Major Blue's at some desperate domestic crisis, and once, when he found his tenant tearing off the butler's turban and coat, he ventured to expostulate and privately asked the major if he was not afraid of appearing before the cantonment magistrate. Not afraid of law proceedings? Law action? I'd like to see them try to bully old Joe Bluer. I'm in my own house, where I do as I please. My house is my castle. Joe Blue's castle. If I were you, my honored sir, I would send away your cook and butler and the waterman. I've heard things. Lowering his voice in the bazaar, hints, whispers. That they rob me? Of course they do. If I may humbly venture to suggest, I would counsel more gentle and polite treatment, honorable sir, and I implore you to get rid of your present servants at once. You may be sorry if you keep them, and so may I. I do not wish to lose an excellent tenant. Now you have been here 13 years. And who the devil said I was going to leave? Bawled the major. Wait till I give you notice. Keep your opinions to yourself, you sniveling, meddling, putting face black brute. Here, get out of the place at once, or I'll help you. And poor timid, well-meaning Mr. Ezra Pedro was fain to retire with undignified celebrity. After a short time, there were whispers and vague rumors that Major Blue Devil, as he was called, had been worse than usual with respect to violence, language, and liquor. He had broken the waterman's head, kicked the cook's wife, mother, and drowned the butler's beloved and only dog. Of late, he had not only been encountered slanting about the highways, and his absence was a relief, nor had he appeared in church or reading room. The individual most interested in his welfare was his landlord, who arrived punctually on the first day of the month, receipt in hand. He rapped timidly. No answer. Then he hammered boldly. After all, there was a month's rent due, and it was his house. Still dead silence. He called a passing acquaintance, and together they peeped around, listened, whispered, wondered, and finally climbed in through an ill-secured window. The bungalow was proved to be as neat as a new pin, and in apple pie order, as it was less furnished as are all Hill houses. The major's bedroom was beautifully tidy. Long double rows of empty bottles stood as if dressed on parade. His clothes were folded up, his topian cap hung below his sword scabbard. His shaving apparatus, razor included, was arranged in tempting order, and a clock was briskly ticking on the chimney piece. The tiny sitting room was chiefly filled by a long chair, a teapoy, pipes, and peg tumblers. It was vacant. Little dining room, here was a promising sign. The cloth was laid in preparation for a meal. There were appointments for two. A cruet stand and a well-filled decanter were set by the major's seat, and a good-sized covered dish was placed before it. The flies were swarming around this, and some rash impulse of curiosity tempted Pedro to raise the electroplated lid. He gave a shrill, wild scream as he let it fall with a frightful clang. For grinning at him on the dish was Major Blue's head. The landlord and his companion tore out of the bungalow, and in the language of old storybooks, they ran and they ran and they ran. They ultimately brought the police and a vast and excited crowd to inspect the ghastly dinner table. The police looked wise, as usual, asked questions, examined the premises, and made copious entries. But from that day to this, a matter of 30 years and more, no trace has ever been found of Major Blue's servants, or of Major Blue's body. Jack Straw's castle was to let, a bargain, for many seasons. And for many seasons it has stood, a roofless ruin. At the end of the passage by Rudyard Kipling. The sky is lead and our faces are red, and the gates of hell are opened and riven, and the winds of hell are loosened and driven, and the dust flies up in the face of heaven, and the clouds come down in a fiery sheet, heavy to raise and hard to be borne, and the soul of man is turned from his meat, turned from the trifles for which he has striven, sick in his body and heavy-hearted, and his soul flies up like dust in the street, breaks from his flesh and is gone and departed, as the blast they blow on the cholera horn. From the Himalayan. Four men, each entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, sat at a table playing whist. The thermometer marked for them 101 degrees of heat. The room was dark until it was only just possible to distinguish the pips of the cards and the very white faces of the players. A tattered, rotten punkah of whitewashed calico was puddling the hot air and whining dolefully at each stroke. Outside lay the gloom of a November day in London. There was neither sky, sun, nor horizon. Nothing but a brown-purple haze of heat. It was as though the earth were dying of apoplexy. From time to time, clouds of tawny dust rose from the ground without wind or warning, flung themselves in tablecloth-wise among the tops of the parched trees, and came down again. Then a whirling dust devil would scudder across the plain for a couple of miles, break and fall outward, though there was nothing to check its flight save a long low line of piled railway sleepers, white with the dust, a cluster of huts made of mud, condemned rails and canvas, and the one squat four-room bungalow that belonged to the assistant engineer in charge of the section of a Godari state line then under construction. The four, stripped to the thinnest of sleeping suits, played whist crossly with wranglings as to leads and returns. It was not the best kind of whist, but they had taken some trouble to arrive at it. Mottram of the Indian Survey had ridden 30 and railed 100 miles from his lonely post in the desert since the night before. Lowndes of the Civil Service on special duty in the political department had come as far to escape for an instant the miserable intrigues of an impoverished native state whose king alternately fawned and blustered for more money from the pitiful revenues contributed by hard-wrung peasants and despairing camel breeders. Spurstow, the doctor of the line, had left a cholera-stricken camp of coolies to look after itself for 48 hours while he associated with white men once more. Humil, the assistant engineer, was the host. He stood fast and received his friends thus every Sunday if they could come in. When one of them failed to appear, he would send a telegram to his last address in order that he might know whether the defaulter were dead or alive. There are many places in the East where it is not good or kind to let your acquaintances drop out of sight, even for one short week. The players were not conscious of any special regard for each other. They squabbled whenever they met, but they ardently desired to meet, as men without water desired to drink. They were lonely folk who understood the dread meaning of loneliness. They were all under 30 years of age, which is too soon for any man to possess that knowledge. "Pilsner," said Spurstow, after the second rubber mopping his forehead. "Beer's out, I'm sorry to say, and there's hardly enough soda water for tonight," said Humil. "What filthy bad management," Spurstow snarled. "Can't help it. I've written and wired, but the trains don't come through regularly yet. Last week the ice ran out, as Lowndes knows. Glad I didn't come. I could have sent you some if I had known, though. Phew, it's too hot to go on playing bumble puppy." This was a savage scowl at Lowndes, who only laughed. He was a hardened offender. Mottram rose from the table and looked out of a chink in the shutters. "What a sweet day," said he. The company yawned altogether and betook themselves to an aimless investigation of Ahumil's possessions. Guns, tattered novels, saddlery, spurs, and the like. They had fingered them a score of times before, but there was really nothing else to do. "Got anything fresh?" said Lowndes. "Last week's Gazette of India and a cutting from a home paper. My father sent it out. It's rather amusing. One of those vestrymen that call themselves MPs again, is it?" said Spurstow, who read his newspapers when he could get them. "Yes, listen to this. It's to your address, Lowndes. The man was making a speech to his constituents, and he piled it on. Here's a sample. And I assert unhesitatingly that the civil service in India is the preserve, the pet preserve of the aristocracy of England. What does democracy, what do the masses, get from that country which we have step by step fraudulently annexed? I answer nothing whatever. It is farmed with a single eye to their own interests by the scions of the aristocracy. They take good care to maintain their lavish scale of incomes, to avoid or stifle any inquiries into the nature and conduct of their administration, while they themselves force the unhappy peasant to pay with the sweat of his brow for all the luxuries in which they are lapped. Humil waved the end cutting above his head. "Ear, ear," said his audience. Then Lowndes, meditatively, I'd give 3 months' pay to have that gentleman spend 1 month with me and see how the free and independent native prince works things. Old Timbersides, this was his flippant title for an honored and decorated feudatory prince, has been wearing my life out this week past for money. By Jove, his latest performance was to send me one of his women as a bribe." "Good for you. Did bid you accept it," said Mottram. "No, I rather wish I had. Now, she was a pretty little person. She yarned away to me about the horrible destitution among the king's women folk. The darlings haven't had any new clothes for nearly a month, and the old man wants to buy a new drag from Calcutta. Solid silver railings and silver lamps, and trifles of that kind. I tried to make him understand that he has played the deuce with the revenues for the last 20 years, and must go slow. He can't see it. But he has the ancestral treasure vaults to draw on. There must be 3 millions at least in jewels and coin under his palace," said Humil. "Catch a native king disturbing the family treasure? The priests forbid it except as a last resort. Old Timbersides has added something like 250,000 to the deposit in his reign." "Where the mischief does it all come from?" said Mottram. "The country, the state of the people, is enough to make you sick. I've known the taxman wait by a milch camel till the foal was born and then hurry off the mother for arrears. And what can I do? I can't get the court clerks to give me any accounts. I can't raise anything more than a fat smile from the commander-in-chief when I find out the troops are 3 months in arrears, and old Timbersides begins to weep when I speak to him. He has taken to the king's peg heavily, liquor brandy for whiskey, and Heidsieck for soda water. That's what the Rav Gibella took to. Even a native can't last long at that," said Spursto. "He'll go out. And a good thing, too. Then I suppose we'll have a council of regency and a tutor for the young prince, and hand him back his kingdom with 10 years' accumulations. Whereupon, that young prince, having been taught all the vices of the English, will pay ducks and drakes with the money and undo 10 years' work in 18 months. I've seen that business before," said Spursto. "I should tackle a king with a light hand if I were you, Lowndes. They'll hate you quite enough under any circumstances." "That's all very well. The man who looks on can talk about the light hand, but you can't clean a pigsty with a pen dipped in rose water. I know my risks, but nothing has happened yet. My servant's an old Pathan, and he cooks for me. They are hardly likely to bribe him, and I don't accept food from my true friends, as they call themselves. Oh, but it's weary work. I'd sooner be with you, Spursto. There's shooting near your camp." "Would you? I don't think it. About 15 deaths a day don't incite a man to shoot anything but himself. And the worst of it is that the poor devils look at you as though you ought to save them. Lord knows I've tried everything. My last attempt was empirical, but it pulled an old man through. He was brought to me apparently past hope, and I gave him gin and Worcestershire sauce with cayenne. It cured him, but I don't recommend it." "How do the cases run generally?" said Humil. "Very simply indeed. Chlordine, opium pill, chlordine, collapse, nitre, bricks to the feet, and then the burning gout. The last seems to be the only thing that stops the trouble. It's black cholera, you know. Poor devils. But I will say, little Bunsi Lau, my apothecary, works like a demon. I recommended him for promotion if he comes through it all alive." "And what are your chances, old man?" said Mottram. "Don't know, don't care much, but I've sent the letter in. What are you doing with yourself generally?" "Sitting under a table in the tent and spitting on the sextant to keep it cool," said the man of the survey. "Washing my eyes to avoid ophthalmia, which I shall certainly get, and trying to make a sub-surveyor understand that an error of 5 degrees in an angle isn't quite so small as it looks. I'm altogether alone, you know, and shall be till the end of the hot weather." "Homile's the lucky man," said Lowndes, flinging himself into a long chair. "He has an actual roof, torn as to the ceiling cloth, but still a roof over his head. He sees one train daily. He can get beer and soda water and ice them when God is good. He has books, pictures. They were torn from the Graphic and the Society of the Excellent Subcontractor Jevons, besides the pleasure of receiving us weekly." Humil smiled grimly. "Yes, I am the lucky man, I suppose. Jevons is luckier." "How? Not?" "Yes, went out last Monday." "By his own hand?" said Spurstow quickly, hinting the suspicion that was in everybody's mind. There was no cholera in Humil's section. Even fevers gives a man at least a week's grace, and sudden death generally implied self-slaughter. "I judge no man this weather," said Humil. "He had a touch of the sun, I fancy, for last week, after you fellows had left, he came into the veranda and told me that he was going home to see his wife in Market Street, Liverpool, that evening. I got the apothecary in to look at him, and we tried to make him lie down. After an hour or two, he rubbed his eyes and said he believed he had had a fit. Hopefully, he hadn't said anything rude. Jevons had a great idea of bettering himself socially. He was very like Chucks in his language. Well, then he went on to his own bungalow and began cleaning a rifle. He told a servant that he was going to shoot buck in the morning. Naturally, he fumbled with the trigger and shot himself through the head, accidentally. The apothecary sent in a report to my chief, and Jevons is buried somewhere out there. I'd have wired you, Spurstall, if you could have done anything. You're a queer chap, said Mottram. If you'd killed the man yourself, you can have been more quiet about the business. Good Lord, what does it matter, said Humil calmly. I've got to do a lot of his overseeing work in addition to my own. I'm the only person that suffers. Jevons is out of it, by pure accident, of course, but out of it. The apothecary was going to write a long screed on suicide. Trust the babu to drivel when he gets the chance. Why didn't you let it go in as suicide, said Landes. No direct proof. A man hasn't many privileges in this country, but he might at least be allowed to mishandle his own rifle. Besides, some day I may need a man to smother up an accident to myself. Live and let live, die and let die. You take a pill, says Spurstall, who had been watching Humil's wet face narrowly. Take a pill, and don't be an ass. That sort of talk is skittles. Anyhow, suicide is shirking your work. If I were jobbed 10 times over, I should be so interested in what was going to happen next day, I'd stay on and watch. I've lost that curiosity, said Humil. Liver out of order, said Landes feelingly. No, can't sleep. That's worse. By Jove, it is, said Mottram. I'm that way every now and then, and the fit has to wear itself out. What do you take for it? Nothing. What's the use? I haven't had 10 minutes sleep since Friday morning. Poor chap. Spurstall, you ought to attend to this, said Mottram. Now you mention it, your eyes are rather gummy and swollen. Spurstall, still watching Humil, laughed lightly. I'll patch him up later on. Is it too hot, do you think, to go for a ride? Where to, said Landes wearily. We shall have to go away at 8, and they'll be riding enough for us then. I hate a horse when I have to use them as a necessity. Oh, heavens, what is there to do? Begin whist again, at chick points. A cheek is supposed to be 8 shillings, and a gold mohur on the rub, says Spurstall promptly. Poker, a month's pay all around for the pool, no limit, and 50 rupee raises. Somebody would be broken before we got up, said Landes. Can't say that it would give me any pleasure to break any man in this company, said Mottram. There isn't enough excitement in it, and it's foolish. He crossed over to the worn and battered little camp piano, wreckage of a married household that had once held the bungalow, and opened the case. It's used up long ago, said Humil. The servants have picked it to pieces. The piano was indeed hopelessly out of order, but Mottram managed to bring the rebellious notes into a sort of agreement, and there rose from the ragged keyboard something that might once have been the ghost of a popular music hall song. The men in the long chairs turned with evident interest as Mottram banged the more lustily. That's good, said Landes. By Jove, the last time I heard that song was in 79, or thereabouts, just before I came out. Ah, said Spurstall with pride. I was home in 80, and he mentioned a song of the streets popular at that date. Mottram executed it roughly. Landes criticized and volunteered emendations. Mottram dashed into another ditty, not of the music hall character, and made as if to rise. Sit down, said Humil. I didn't know that you had any music in your composition. Go on playing until you can't think of anything more. I'll have that piano tuned up before you come again. Play something festive. Very simple indeed were the tunes to which Mottram's art and the limitations of the piano could give effect. But the men listened with pleasure, and in the pauses talked altogether of what they had seen or heard when they were last at home. A dense dust storm sprang up outside and swept roaring over the house, enveloping in the choking darkness of midnight. But Mottram continued unheeding, and the crazy tinkle reached the ears of the listeners above the flapping of the tattered ceiling cloth. In the silence after the storm, he glided from the more directly personal songs of Scotland, half humming them as he played, into the evening hymn. Sunday, said he, nodding his head. Go on, don't apologize for it, said Spurstall. Humil laughed long and riotously. Play it, by all means. You're full of surprises today. I didn't know you had such a gift to finish sarcasm. How does that thing go? Matram took up the tune. Too slow by half. You missed the note of gratitude, said Humil. It ought to go to the grasshopper's polka, this way. And he chanted, Prestissimo. Glory to thee, my God, this night for all the blessings of the light. That shows we really feel our blessings. How does it go on? If in the night I sleepless lie, my soul with sacred thoughts supply, may no ill dreams disturb my rest. Quicker, Matram, or powers of darkness me molest. Ah, what an old hypocrite you are. Don't be an ass, said Landes. You are full liberty to make fun of anything else you like, but leave that hymn alone. It's associated in my mind with the most sacred recollections. Summer evenings in the country, stained glass window, light going out, and you and she jamming your heads together over one hymn book, said Matram. Yes, and a fat old cockchafer hitting you in the eye when you walked home. Smell of hay and a moon as big as a bandbox sitting on the top of a haycock. Bats, roses, milk, and midges, said Landes. Also mothers. I can just recollect my mother singing me to sleep with that when I was a little chap, said Svirstow. The darkness had fallen on the room. They could hear Hamil squirming in his chair. Consequently, said he testily, you sing it when you are 7 fathoms deep in hell. It's an insult to the intelligence of the deity to pretend we're anything but tortured rebels. Take 2 pills, said Svirstow. That's tortured liver. The usually placid Humil is in a vile bad temper. I'm sorry for his coolies tomorrow, said Landes, as his servants brought in the lights and prepared the table for dinner. As they were settling into their places about the miserable goat chops and the smoked tapioca pudding, Svirstow took occasion to whisper to Matram, well done, David. Look after Saul, then, was the reply. What are you two whispering about, said Humil suspiciously. Only saying that you are a damn poor host. This fell can't be cut, returns Svirstow with a sweet smile. Call this a dinner? Can't help it. You don't expect a banquet, do you? Throughout the meal, Humil contrived laboriously to insult directly and pointedly all his guests in succession, and at each insult Svirstow kicked the aggrieved person under the table, but he dared not exchange a glance of intelligence with either of them. Humil's face was white and pinched, while his eyes were naturally large. No man dreamed for a moment of resenting his savage personalities, but as soon as the meal was over, they made haste to get away. Don't go. You're just getting amusing, you fellows. I hope I haven't said anything that annoyed you. You're such touchy devils. Then changing the note into one of his most abject entreaty, Humil added, I say, you surely aren't going. In the language of the blessed Jaraks, where I dines, I sleep, said Svirstow. I want to have a look at your coolies tomorrow, if you don't mind. You can give me a place to lie down in, I suppose. The other pleaded the urgency of their several duties next day, and saddling up departed together, Humil begging them to come next Sunday. As they jogged off, Landes unbosomed himself to Matram. And I never felt so like kicking a man at his own table in my life. He said I cheated at whist and reminded me I was in debt. Told you were as good as a liar to your face. You aren't half indignant enough over it. Not I, said Matram. Poor devil. Did you ever know old Hummy behave like that before or within 100 miles of it? It's no excuse. Svirstow was hacking my shin all the time, so I kept a hand on myself. Else I should have... No, you wouldn't. You'd have done as Hummy did about Jevons. Judge no man this weather. By Jove, the buckle of my brittle is hot in my hand. Trot out a bit and wear rat holes. 10 minutes trotting jerked out of Landes one very sage remark when he pulled up sweating from every pore. Good thing Svirstow's with him tonight. Yes, good man Svirstow. Our roads turn here. See you again next Sunday, if the sun doesn't bowl me over. Suppose so, unless old Timberside's finance minister manages to dress some of my food. Good night, and God bless you. What's wrong now? Oh, nothing, Landes gathered up his whip, and as he flicked Matram's mare on the flank, added, you're not a bad little chap, that's all. And the mare bolted half a mile across the land on the word. And the assistant engineer's bungalow, Svirstow and Hummel, smoked the pipe of silence together, each narrowly watching the other. The capacity of a bachelor's establishment is as elastic as its arrangements are simple. A servant cleared away the dining room table, brought in a couple of rude native bedsteads made of tape strung on a light wood frame, flung a square of cool Calcutta matting over each of them, side by side, pinned two towels to the punkah so that their fringes should just sweep clear of the sleeper's nose and mouth, and announced that the couches were ready. The men flung themselves down, ordering the punkah coolies by all the powers of hell to pull. Every door and window was shut, for the outside air was that of an oven. The atmosphere within was only 104 degrees, as a thermometer bore witness, and heavy with the foul smell of badly trimmed kerosene lamps, and this stench combined with that of native tobacco, baked brick, and dried earth, sends the heart of many a strong man down to his boots, for it is the smell of the great Indian Empire, when she turns herself for 6 months into a house of torment. Spurstall packed his pills craftily so that he reclined rather than lay, his head at a safe elevation above his feet. It is not good to sleep on a low pillow in the hot weather, if you happen to be thick-necked build, for you may pass with lively snores and gugglings from natural sleep into the deep slumber of heat apoplexy. "Pack your pillows," said the doctor sharply, as he saw Hummel preparing to lie down at full length. The night light was trimmed, the shadows of the punkah wavered across the room, and the flick of the punkah towel and the soft whine of the rope through the waho followed it. Then the punkah flagged, almost ceased. The sweat poured from Spurstall's brow. Should he go out and harangue the coolie? It started forward again with a savage jerk, and a pin came out of the towels. When this was replaced, tom-tom in the coolie lines began to beat with a steady throb of a swollen artery inside some brain-fevered skull. Spurstall turned on his side and swore gently. There was no movement on Homo's part. The man had composed himself as rigidly as a corpse, his hands clenched at his sides. The respiration was too hurried for any suspicion of sleep. Spurstall looked at the set face. The jaws were clenched, and there was a pucker around the quivering eyelids. "He's holding himself as tightly as ever he can," thought Spurstall. "What in the world is the matter with him? Hummel?" "Yes," in a thick, constrained voice. "Can't you get to sleep?" "No." "Head hot? Throat feeling bulgy? Or how?" "Neither, thanks. I don't sleep much, you know." "Feel pretty bad?" "Pretty bad, thanks. There's a tom-tom outside, isn't there? I thought it was my head at first. Oh, Spurstall, for pity's sake, give me something that will put me asleep. Sound asleep. If it's only for 6 hours." He sprang up trembling from head to foot. "I haven't been able to sleep naturally for days, and I can't stand it. I can't stand it." "Poor old chap." "That's no use. Give me something to make me sleep, I tell you. I'm nearly mad. I don't know what I say half my time. For 3 weeks I've had to think and spell out every word that has come through my lips before I dare say it. Isn't that enough to drive a man mad? I can't see things correctly now, and I've lost my sense of touch. My skin aches. My skin aches. Make me sleep, or suppose thou. For the love of God, make me sleep sound. It isn't enough to merely let me dream. Let me sleep." "All right, old man, all right. Go slow. You aren't half as bad as you think." The floodgates of reserve once broken, Hummel was clinging to him like a frightened child. "You're pinching my arm to pieces." "I'll break your neck if you don't do something for me." "No, I didn't mean that. Don't be angry, old fellow." He wiped the sweat off himself as he fought to regain composure. "I'm a bit restless and off my oats, and perhaps you could recommend some sort of sleeping mixture. Bromide of potassium?" "Bromide of Skittles." "Why didn't you tell me this before? Let go of my arm, and I'll see if there's anything in my cigarette case to suit your complaint." Spurstall hunted among his day clothes, turned up the lamp, opened a little silver cigarette case, and advanced on the expectant Hummel with the daintiest of fairy squirts. "The last appeal of civilization," said he, "and a thing I hate to use. Hold out your arm. Well, your sleepiness hasn't ruined your muscle, and what a thick hide it is. Might as well inject the buffalo subcutaneously. Now, in a few minutes, the morphia will begin working. Lie down and wait." A smile of unalloyed and idiotic delight began to creep over Hummel's face. "I think," he whispered, "I think I'm going off now. Gad, it's positively heavenly. Spurstall, you must give me that case to keep you." The voice ceased as the head fell back. "Not for a good deal," said Spurstall to the unconscious form. "And now, my friend, sleeplessness of your kind, being very apt to relax the moral fiber in little matters of life and death, I'll just take the liberty of spiking your guns." He paddled into Hummel's side room, in his bare feet, and uncased a 12-bore rifle, an express, and a revolver, Of the first, he unscrewed the nipples and hid them in the bottom of a saddlery case. Of the second, he abstracted the lever, kicking it behind a big wardrobe. The third, he merely opened and knocked the doll head bolt of the grip up with the heel of a riding boot. "That's settled," he said, as he shook the sweat off his hands. "These little precautions will at least give you time to turn. You have too much sympathy with gunroom accidents." And as he rose from his knees, the thick, muffled voice of Hummel cried in the doorway, "You fool!" Such tones they use who speak in the lurid intervals of delirium to their friends, a little before they die. Spurs now startled, dropping the pistol. Hummel stood in the doorway, rocking with helpless laughter. "That was awfully good of you, I'm sure," he said very slowly, feeling for his words. "I don't intend to go out by my own hand at present. I say, sirs, thou, that stuff won't work. What shall I do? What shall I do?" And panic, terror stood in his eyes. "Lie down and give it a chance. Lie down at once." "I daren't. It will only take me halfway again, and I shan't be able to get away this time. Do you know it was all I could do to come out just now? Generally, I'm as quick as lightning, but you had clogged my feet. I was nearly caught." "Oh, yes, I understand. Go and lie down." "No, it isn't delirium, but it was an awfully mean trick to play on me. Do you know I might have died?" As a sponge rubs the slate clean, so some power known to Spurstyle had wiped out Hummel's face, all that was stamped it for the face of a man, and he stood at the door with an expression of his lost innocence. He had slept back into terrified childhood. "Is he going to die on the spot?" thought Spurstyle. Then aloud, "All right, my son. Come back to bed and tell me all about it. You couldn't sleep. But what was all the rest of the nonsense?" "A place. A place down there," said Hummel, with simple sincerity. The drug was acting on him by waves, and he was flung from the fear of a strong man to the fright of a child as his nerves, gathered senses, were dulled. "Good God. I've been afraid of it for months past," burst out. "It has made every night hell to me, and yet I'm not conscious of having done anything wrong." "Be still, and I'll give you another dose. We'll stop your nightmares, you unutterable idiot." "Yes, but you must give me so much that I can't get away. You must make me quite sleepy, not just a little sleepy." "It's hard to run then." "I know it. I know it. I felt it myself. The symptoms are exactly as you describe." "Oh, don't laugh at me, confound you. Before this awful sleeplessness came to me, I've tried to rest on my elbow and put a spur in the bed to sting me when I fell back. Look." By Jove, the man had been riled like a horse, ridden by the nightmare with a vengeance, and we all thought him sensible enough. Heaven send us understanding. You like to talk, don't you? Yes, sometimes. Not when I'm frightened. Then I want to run, don't you? Always. Before I give you second dose, try to tell me exactly what your trouble is. Hummel spoke in broken whispers for nearly 10 minutes, while his Spurstyle looked into the pupils of his eyes and passed his hand before them once or twice. At the end of the narrative, the silver cigarette case was produced. The last words that Hummel said as he fell back for the second time were, "Put me quite to sleep, for if I'm caught, I die. I die." "Yes, yes, we all do that sooner or later. Thank Kevin, who has set a term to our miseries," said Spurstyle, settling the cushions under the head. "It occurs to me that unless I drink something, I shall go out before my time. I've stopped sweating, and I wear a 17-inch collar." He brewed himself scalding hot tea, which is an excellent remedy against heat apoplexy. You take 3 or 4 cups of it in a time. Then he watched the sleeper. A blind face that cries and can't wipe its eyes. A blind face that chases him down corridors. Decidedly, Hummel ought to go and leave as soon as possible. And sane or otherwise, he undoubtedly did rile himself most cruelly. Well, heaven send us understanding. At midday, Hummel rose, with an evil taste in his mouth, but an unclouded eye and a joyful heart. "I was pretty bad last night, wasn't I?" said he. "I've seen healthier men. You might have had a touch of the sun. Look here, I write you a swinging medical certificate. Will you apply for leave on the spot?" "No." "Why not? You want it." "Yes, but I can hold on till the weather's a little cooler." "Why should you, if you can get relieved on the spot? Burkett is the only man who could be sent, and he's a born fool." "Oh, never mind about the line. You aren't so important as all that. Wire for leave, if necessary. Hummel looked very uncomfortable. I can hold on till the rains, he said evasively. You can't. Wire to headquarters for Burkett. I won't. If you want to know why, particularly Burkett is married, and his wife just had a kid, and she's up at Simla in the cool, and Burkett has a very nice billet that takes him into Simla from Saturday to Monday. That little woman isn't at all well. If Burkett was transferred, she tried to follow him. If she left the baby behind, she'd fret herself to death. If she came, and Burkett's one of those selfish little beasts who are always talking about a wife's place being with her husband, she'd die. It's murder to bring a woman here just now. Burkett hasn't the physique of a rat. If he came here, he'd go out, and I know she hasn't any money, and I'm pretty sure she'd go out too. I'm salted in a sort of way, and I'm not married. Wait till the rains, and then Burkett can get down here. It'll do him heaps of good. Do you mean to say that you intend to face what you have faced till the rains break? Oh, it won't be so bad. Now you've shown me a way out of it. I can always wire to you. Besides, now I've got into the way of sleeping, it'll be all right. Anyhow, I shan't put in for leave. That's the long and short of it. Great Scott, I thought all that sort of thing was dead and done with. Bosh, you do the same yourself. I feel a new man thanks to that cigarette case. You're going over to camp now, aren't you? Yes, but I'll try to look you up every other day if I can. I'm not bad enough for that. I don't want you to bother. Give the coolies gin and ketchup. Then you feel all right? Fit to fight for my life, but not to stand out in the sun talking to you. Go along, old man, and bless you. Hummel turned on his heel to face the echoing desolation of his bungalow, and the first thing he saw standing in the veranda was the figure of himself. He had met a similar apparition once before, when he was suffering from overwork and the strain of the hot weather. This is bad. Already, said, rubbing his eyes. If the thing slides away from me all in one piece like a ghost, I shall know it is only my eyes and stomach that are out of order. If it walks, my head is going. He approached the figure, which naturally kept at an unvarying distance from him, as is the use of all specters that are born of overwork. It slid through the house and dissolved into swimming specks within the eyeballs as soon as it reached the burning light of the garden. Hummel went about his business till evening. When he came in to dinner, he found himself sitting at the table. The vision rose and walked out hastily. Except that it cast no shadow, it was in all respects real. No living man knows what that week held for Hummel. An increase of the epidemic kept spurs down in camp among the coolies, and all he could do was to telegraph to Matram, bidding him go to the bungalow and sleep there. But Matram was 40 miles away from the nearest telegraph, and knew nothing of anything save the needs of the survey, till he met, early on Sunday morning, Lowndes and Spurstow heading towards Hummel's for the weekly gathering. "Hope the poor chap's in better temper," said the former, swinging himself off his horse at the door. "I suppose he isn't up yet." "I'll just have a look at him," said the doctor. "If he's asleep, there's no need to wake him." And an instant later, by the tone of Spurstow's voice calling upon them to enter, the men knew what had happened. There was no need to wake him. The punkah was still being pulled over the bed, but Hummel had departed this life at least 3 hours. The body lay on its back, hands clinched by the side, as Spurstow had seen it lying 7 nights previously. In the staring eyes was written terror beyond the expression of any pen. Matram, who had entered behind Lowndes, bent over the dead and touched the forehead lightly with his lips. "Oh, you lucky, lucky devil," he whispered. But Lowndes had seen the eyes and withdrew shuddering to the other side of the room. "Poor chap, poor old chap. And the last time I met him, I was angry. Spurstow, we should have watched him, has he?" Deftly Spurstow continued his investigations, ending by a search around the room. "No, he hasn't," he snapped. "There's no trace of anything. Call his servants." They came, 8 or 10 of them, whispering and peering over each other's shoulder. "When did your sahib go to bed?" said Spurstow. "At 11 or 10, we think," said Hummel's personal servant. "He was well then, but how should you know?" "He was not ill, as far as our comprehension extended, but he had slept very little for 3 nights. This I know because I saw him walking much, and especially in the heart of the night." As Spurstow was arranging the sheet, a big straight-necked hunting spur tumbled on the ground. The doctor groaned. The personal servant peeped at the body. "What do you think, Chuma?" says Spurstow, catching the look on the dark face. Heaven born, in my poor opinion. This that was my master has descended into the dark places, and there has been caught because he was not able to escape with sufficient speed. We have the spur for evidence that he fought with fear. Thus have I seen men of my race do with thorns when a spell was laid upon them to overtake them in their sleeping hours, and they dared not sleep. Chuma, you're a mudhead. Go out and prepare seals to be set on the Sahib's property. God has made the heaven born. God has made me. Who are we to inquire into the dispensations of God? I will bid the other servants hold aloof while you are reckoning the tale of the Sahib's property. They are all thieves and would steal. As far as I can make out, he died from, anything, stoppage of the heart's action, heat apoplexy, or some other visitation, said spurst out to his companions. We must make an inventory of his effects, and so on. He was scared to death, insisted Lowndes. Look at those eyes, for pity's sake. Don't let him be buried with them open. Whatever it was, he's clear of all the trouble now, said Matram softly. Spurstow was peering into the open eyes. Come here, said he. Can you see anything there? I can't face it, whispered Lowndes. Cover up the face. Is there any fear on earth that can turn a man into that likeness? It's ghastly. Oh, Spurstow, cover it up. No fear on earth, said Spurstow. Matram leaned over his shoulder and looked intently. I see nothing except some gray blurs in the pupil. There can be nothing there, you know. Even so, well, let's think. It'll take half a day to knock up any sort of coffin, and he must have died at midnight. Lowndes, old man, go out and tell the coolies to break ground next to Jevon's grave. Matram, go round the house with Chuma and see that the seals are put on things. Send a couple of men to me here, and I'll arrange. The strong-armed servants, when they returned to their own kind, told a strange story of the Dr. Sahib vainly trying to call their master back to life by magic arts, to wit, the holding of a little green box that clicked to each of the dead man's eyes, and of a bewildered muttering on the part of the Dr. Sahib, who took the little green box away with him. The resonant hammering with a coffin lid is no pleasant thing to hear, but those of experience maintain that much more terrible is the soft swish of the bed linens, the reeving and unreeving of the bed tapes, when he who has fallen by the roadside is apparelled for burial, sinking gradually as the tapes are tied over, till the swaddled shape touches the floor and there is no protest against the indignity of hasty disposal. At the last moment, Lowndes was seized with scruples of conscience. "Ought you to read the service from beginning to end?" said he to Spurstow. "I intend to. You're my senior as a civilian. You can take it if you like. I didn't mean that for a moment. I only thought if we could get a chaplain from somewhere, I'm willing to ride anywhere, and give poor Hummel a better chance, that's all." "Bosh," said Spurstow, as he framed his lips to the tremendous words that stand at the head of the burial service. After breakfast, he smoked a pipe in silence to the memory of the dead, and Spurstow said absently, "'Tis an immeasurable science." "What?" "Things in a dead man's eye." "For goodness sake, leave that horror alone," said Jaundiz. "I've seen a native die of pure fright when a tiger chivied him. I know what killed Hummel." "The deuce you do. I'm going to try to see." And the doctor retreated into the bathroom with a Kodak camera. After a few minutes, there was a sound of something being hammered to pieces, and he emerged, very white indeed. "Have you got a picture?" said Matram. "What does the thing look like?" "It was impossible, of course." "You needn't look, Matram. I've torn up the film. There was nothing there. It was impossible." "That," said Lowndes very distinctly, watching the shaking hand, striving to relight the pipe, "is a damned lie." Matram laughed uneasily. "Spurstow's right," he said. "We're all in such a state now that we'd believe anything. For pity's sake, let's try to be rational." There was no further speech for a long time. The hot wind whistled without, and the dry tree sobbed. Presently, the daily train, winking brass, burnished steel, and spouting steam, pulled up panting in the intense glare. "We'd better go on that," said Spurstow. "Go back to work. I've written my certificate. We can't do any more good here, and work will keep our wits together. Come on." No one moved. It is not pleasant to face railway journeys at midday in June. Spurstow gathered up his hat and whip, and turning in the doorway said, "There may be heaven, there must be hell. Meantime, there's our life here. Well, Neither Mottram nor Lowndes had any answer to the question.